Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everybody, welcome to this special edition of Mindshift Podcast. I'm not going to call it a bonus episode, I'm just going to call it a special episode, special edition. I don't even know what we call it because Renee Kordeski from Australia, from Melbourne, Australia, contacted me just a couple days ago and said that there's an upcoming massive conference in Melbourne in the Jehovah's Witness community, and she's trying to get the word out about a lot of the issues within the Watchtower. And certainly we know from talking to other ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, survivors of sexual abuse, this has long been a pattern, covering up and hiding, downplaying, moving people around within the Watchtower organization, not just in Australia, but around the world. And of course, we know that there was this Royal Commission that was done a few years ago, and that included the Jehovah's Witnesses, and that has opened the door, I think, to a lot. We'll find out more in a minute when we talk to Renee about this, but this is a huge issue, and I'm glad that we can get the word out. So let's go into it. Thank you, Renee Kordeski, for joining me here early in the morning in the UK, but it's evening there in Melbourne, isn't it?
It's in Sydney. I'm in Sydney.
Oh, Sydney, yes.
You're right. 6 p.m. at the moment, or quarter past six.
Right, so I got up early this morning, but I'm super happy to get up early on a Sunday. I'm not going to be going to church today. I'm going to be talking to Renee about your activism, and this is so important. So thank you for working around this issue, getting the word out on what's going on within the Watchtower organization. And we know, obviously, it's not just limited to Australia, is it? This is a worldwide systemic issue within the Watchtower.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, child sexual abuse cover-ups is definitely an issue. Up until the Royal Commission, what happened is the Jehovah's Witnesses looked pretty squeaky clean. They looked like a very genuine group, a harmless, friendly, door-knocking religious group. But with the Royal Commission, that squeaky clean image disappeared very quickly when it was uncovered that a lot of child sexual abuse incidents hadn't been reported to police at all. Over 1,800 victims of child sexual abuse had not been reported, not one single case been reported to police.
Yes, so, it's been covered up. It's been, and there's been a systemic effort to cover those up, haven't there? And we know that some of this relates to their practice of what they call the two witness rule. Isn't that right? Where they take a verse from the Old Testament that says, if only one witness to a crime comes forward, that somehow isn't legitimate. So let's say you have a child that's been abused within the Watchtower organization, within a JW center. They report it, but oh no, it was only one. So legitimately, we can't do anything with this. Sorry, off you go. Isn't that kind of a lot of the foundation behind why they claim to have covered it up?
Exactly. So they're using a scriptural basis that states that two witnesses before you can investigate a matter. So if there were no two witnesses, and which child abuse case has two witnesses?
Exactly.
You know, Clint.
Except the perpetrator and the victim generally. And the perpetrator is obviously not going to, oh, yeah, I was a witness because I was the one doing that to the child. Obviously, it's in their best interest to deny it.
Yeah, and so that's what the Royal Commission found, is that as an organization, the policies and procedures that the Jehovah's Witnesses had in place with their manuals, because they do have an elder's manual called Shepherding the Flock, they didn't respond adequately to allegations of child sexual abuse, and that's why they basically found themselves with not such a squeaky clean, you know, reputation anymore.
And I'm sure we can get into this more as we get into the actual conference that's coming up, because we know through the work of some other activists around the world that the Watchtower has paid out, isn't it, like millions of dollars and pounds to silence victims or in lawsuits. So this is all starting to come out. They have systematically had this, not only covering things up, but then paying people off to silence witnesses.
That's right. There are many, if you just Google it, really, there are many cases reported on the media that show that many payouts have been and made. And yeah, even with the recent, they appealed to the Supreme Court recently for a case in Montana, I believe it is, and the appeal was rejected. So they are now having to, sorry, it wasn't Montana, I apologize, but it was a case that they appealed and it has now been rejected. So that, yeah, it's definitely coming clear across that these hidden situations can no longer be hidden.
Yeah, I'm glad that it's starting to come out and become, it's being dragged out into the light. Well, maybe we can work our way toward this specific conference that's coming up. The conference is in Melbourne, right? Is that right? And you're in Sydney. Exactly. Okay.
Yeah, I'm organizing it from Sydney, but I'm not the only one. There's about five of us working together. Some are from Melbourne, some are from Brisbane, but we're all working together because in November from the 22nd to 24th, Jehovah's Witnesses have an international convention in Melbourne, and they're expecting somewhere between 60 and 70,000 Jehovah's Witnesses to attend.
So it's going to be a massive conference, and it's actually it's sponsored by the Watchtower, the Jehovah's Witness organization. So you're organizing kind of a protest. Well, let's work our way toward that because I want to find out your activism. But what's your own backstory? You're an ex-Jehovah's Witness yourself. Can you give us a little bit of insight as to your own experiences within the Watchtower?
Absolutely. So the reason why I am protesting next month is because of just what I've been through in my life. And I'm not the only one. I've become a bit of an advocate in the sense that I show my story. I share my story. And hundreds of people on my page say, oh, that's exactly how I feel. So I've become an advocate because I was a born-in Jehovah's Witness. This means that from the very minute I was born, I began this process of indoctrination, and which consisted of many rigid rules. It just is. I'm sure you understand what it's like to be indoctrinated. I probably don't have to explain too much, but my family actually suffered severe domestic violence because my father was actually not a Jehovah's Witness, and he was really against it, and he was actually quite violent towards my mum. And because of that, because of the rigid religious rules and policies within Watchtower, my mum wasn't allowed to leave my dad. She was strongly discouraged. Mm-hmm. And so she almost lost her life one night. It was quite violent. And what I'm saying is the reason I'm protesting is there's a lot of aspects of this religion that cause harm to people. So you can imagine all the kids that have to put up with domestic violence because a parent is not allowed to leave a violent, abusive parent. It just creates situations where it's just really unhealthy and dangerous, you know, for kids to be brought up into this.
Mm.
So that's why I'm protesting. Domestic violence is a massive thing for me. There was also an incident of sexual abuse, not by a Jehovah's Witness, but I brought the matter to the elders, and the way it was dealt with, it's very dismissive. The way women are treated and children are treated, females are treated, it was extremely dismissive, and it must have been something that I did or I should take care in future. I must have done something to encourage it, and the poor male, these are the feelings that they have. He can't, because he's a male and he has these feelings, he has these needs. So all this,
you must have done something.
Yeah. So all these ridiculous notions really damage a child. They really have a set of procedures, policies, and culture that is extremely dangerous for kids. But the biggest thing is, I think, obviously, when I reached 21 and I was disfellowshipped, which is a term for being cast out, and then my entire family shunned me. That was 23 years ago, and I haven't seen my three brothers. I've had nieces and nephews born, and I haven't met them. I've met them very briefly, but basically I haven't gotten to know them. So the whole aspect of that manipulation of controlling the community by who they speak to and how much influence they have on, you know, on my family to control and make them mentally trapped so that they can't speak to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a really dangerous set of circumstances for people to have to put up with.
Absolutely.
So all these things together, look, is, you know, are the reasons why I want to protest and stand up and make a point.
It's a toxic mix, isn't it? It's a, you're creating an environment that's rife for abuses to occur. And that is, we were talking before we hit record about the sort of common threads in your story, my story, other people's stories that came out of different controlling religions. As Chris Shelton says, if you strip away the ideology, in many cases, what you're left with is the same psychology. In whether you're an ex-Scientologist, ex-Mormon, ex-Evangelical, ex-Jehovah's Witness, we find those threads that you just described. Growing up in a cult, I mean, I'm like you in the sense I was born into it. So I was indoctrinated just like you from day one. Okay, it was fundamentalist Christianity, but you can see the common parallels in our stories, the behavior control, the information control, the thought control, the emotional control, Stephen Hassan's bite model. We could say that applies. And I'm sure you could go down those four markers and say, yep, all those things applied to me. And on top of that, it's a system whereby abusers are actually, you know, it's a system. It's rife for abuse, and then they're covered up. And like you say, you're not allowed to divorce, because we see the same thing in the church. People that are, people that are trapped in marriages that are abusive, the Bible says you're not supposed to get a divorce unless it's in the case of sexual infidelity. And if he's not cheating on you, well, sorry, you're just going to have to put up with the abuse.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I totally agree with everything you're saying. So we do have very similar things in common with just the undue influence that these groups, you know, promote and how far they go to influence how a person thinks or acts. And like you said, even things like thought stopping techniques that they use, that really worked with me, Clint. I was actually, when I was disfellowshipped at 21, I actually didn't wake up for about 19 years.
Wow.
Because they had trained me really well that I was a bad person. I had left the group. I needed to get back in. I wasn't ready to get back in, and something inside me didn't want to get back in. But that whole time, I felt like I was unworthy and guilty, and I had to drink. So all this undue influence, it actually took me 19 years to finally allow some critical thinking to happen. Before that, I had been trained to have thought-stopping techniques. If anything bad about Jehovah or his organization came to my mind, I quickly blocked them. Or if I saw anything online, on the internet, that they taught me that that was like Satan's way of trying to get into me, into my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really clever techniques that
yes,
I'm sure are parallel in many of our groups. And it's
all designed
to manipulate and to, to control, isn't it?
It is, and it's designed to stop critical thinking. As you say, there's what they call loaded language, thought-terminating cliches. The language is designed, these short, pithy, sort of memorable phrases that as soon as you start having a doubt, bam, here comes the loaded language, and it's loaded with the ideology of that particular group. So my analogy is sort of like a freight train. You can put whatever baggage or cargo inside the empty boxcar, you know. So in your case, it was Jehovah's Witnesses. My case, it was Christian theology. In someone else's, it might be Scientology or Mormon. Every cult has that loaded language, thought-terminating cliches. And I think there's another aspect to this, that, as you described, these patterns actually, we know now, affect us neurologically. So it's a physical thing as well. Those, as you say, being trained, it actually does something to our brains. As you described, you're automatically just slotted into this groove. As soon as you have a doubt, bam, here comes the thought-terminating cliche. What's that about? It takes a long time to sort of reprogram your brain, really. So, yeah, cults can do a tremendous amount of damage, even neurologically.
Yeah. And the other incredible thing that they do is something that stopped me from also getting help is when I was being brought up, I was really trained that anybody outside the group is dangerous. And that's why they stop you from talking to anybody outside the group. But what happened is when I left, I was too afraid to seek help as well. And that's why I'm worried about there might be thousands or hundreds of thousands of former Jehovah's Witnesses out there who are too afraid to go into that next step of A, doing the critical thinking, and B, seeking help, because they've been trained that they can't seek help from therapists or any institutions because it's supposedly part of Satan's world. So that's why I think the protest is important too, because it's just getting the word out there and just sparking people's minds that, you know, something isn't right and you've got to listen to your gut. If your gut is saying something isn't quite right, you've got to pay attention to it and you've got to follow that thought through and think about it.
That's what they say is that's your authentic personality coming out. That's the real you that's been suppressed or denied or doubled. I was thinking there were two more markers of cults that you've been describing. One is that they succeed by creating an us versus them mentality, which is what you just described, implanting phobias and fears of the outside world. That's a means, A, of controlling you while you're in the group, and then B, stopping you from leaving. And if you do leave, then as you've just described, you're then afraid to make those connections to the outside world because, of course, they're evil and satanic and whatever. The other thing is what Lifton calls the dispensing of existence, which is the shunning piece. As you're an ex-Jehovah's Witness, you're an apostate, you are therefore, you don't exist anymore. And that mentality, that's why I can shun you, I need to shun you, because you're now one of them, Renee. Sorry, you're one of those satanic hordes out there that's being influenced by Satan.
And that's so powerful. I remember when I was a kid, I think I was only about 8 or 9, and we had a disfellowship person in our kingdom hall or church, whatever you want to call it. And I was trained so early, and it's incredible that my gut instinct didn't kick in then. I was trained to treat this person as if they were dead. So this conditioning is so powerful that even within the group. Now, Clint, the group, when you're in it, is wonderful.
Oh,
so
yes.
When you're inside the Jehovah's Witnesses in that kingdom hall with your mates, with your friends, there's an incredible amount of camaraderie. Mm. There is so much seeming happiness and connection.
Community.
Community.
Yeah.
And so it is very easy with all the love bombing to create a bubble of happiness or seeming happiness in there. And so then it's easy for them to say, well, outside is bad. Outside is horrible. If you do live outside, you're not going to have success. You're going to want to come back in the fold.
Right. Why would you want to lose all this? This is wonderful.
Exactly.
They've created a perfect little bubble.
Yeah. And this is what's hard with current Jehovah's Witnesses is they truly believe they're in a form of paradise right now with the group of people.
Mm.
They actually don't realize that the whole organization has created this massive dependency where they're dependent on this group and that they're actually being extremely obedient to this group's policies and they're foregoing freedoms. They don't realize they're foregoing freedoms because this group has cleverly managed to let them think that they're in an incredible situation, the best life ever, I think they call it at the moment.
The best life ever.
There's a hashtag on the internet, the best life ever, if you look that up, and you'll see lots of smiling, happy witnesses. But the truth is that they are denied education because they're not allowed to get educated. They're denied a possibility to become settled, you know, in a material way. For example, I've got a brother who's in his 50s. And now when I was a kid, when I was 15, the end was going to come then. So we didn't need to get any houses or education. Now he's 50 and he's just bought his house. And I just feel for him. I know he's unwell. He's trying to meet mortgage repayments. And I don't have contact with him. And I feel a bit bad talking about him because this is about me. But I know that he's unwell, and I can just imagine what a burden it would be to get a Sydney-priced
mortgage. It's so expensive.
At 50 years of age, you know, with a young child as well. So I really feel for what witnesses are going through. They are truly deprived, and they just don't see it. They're just giving up so much, and it's just such a shame.
But I remember something, I talked to Rick Ross, who's a cult expert, American cult expert, and he said, as long as you're in that bubble that you described, you're plugged into their system, you're receiving their downloads. It makes it incredibly difficult to think critically, as you've just so eloquently described. That's the picture, isn't it? And there is a lot of happiness, but what about the poor child that's being abused in that perfect quote unquote little bubble? That's one of the major problems, or that domestic violence situation that's being reported to the elders of that Watchtower Center, church, or whatever you want to call it, Kingdom Hall, that then gets shunned or overlooked or suppressed or buried. Now it's not so perfect, is it, for that poor exactly. little kid who's being abused?
And Clint, realistically, when we protest, I think the majority of us would realize that it's not like we're going to stop the religion. We're not going to be able to do that. But what we're hoping to do is for them to reevaluate their policies, reevaluate their stance. First of all, apologize to survivors and acknowledge them, because at the moment, Australia has a redress scheme. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Mm-mm.
So it's a scheme following the Royal Commission. If you were found to have not met the requirements to adequately, you know, look after children in your institution, then you obviously had to admit fault and pay some sort of redress to the survivors. And Jehovah's Witnesses are one of the very few groups who are refusing to join the redress scheme. They are refusing to acknowledge there's a problem. As you know, they get online and they say, we don't have a problem. So we just need this shift in their culture to admit that they've made a mistake and to make way to compensate victims. And now I've spoken to so many victims, Jehovah's Witnesses are going to say, oh, they just want money. And I can tell you that every victim I've spoken to, the first thing they say, I do not care about the money. I just want to be heard, and I want them to acknowledge that they hurt me and that their policies caused me to suffer and kept me in silence for so many years. All they needed, all those kids needed, was for somebody to stand up and say, I'm sorry this happened, this is wrong, and help them heal rather than silence them. And I can just feel sick at the thought of all these kids who have grown up being silenced and they're, you know, not being heard. That's the biggest crime ever. So I think, out of this protest, if we can just get them acknowledging that they've made mistakes and repair that damage somehow in some small, you know, gesture and work towards looking over the policies so that there is no more harming of children, not just in child sexual abuse matters, but in many other things. One thing that is close to my heart is the bombardment of the propaganda that manipulates by creating a phobia of Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a really true, massive fear that so many former Jehovah's Witnesses struggle with. I have a friend who's been out for 10, 15 years, and they still have nightmares about Armageddon. Now, that is because as children, we were psychologically abused with inappropriate propaganda material. So I think a secondary thing that I would love to see is an authority that looks into the propaganda that's being disseminated and make sure that it's appropriate for children. Something
Absolutely.
As simple as that. It's imperative to help children grow up psychologically, you know, healthy and stable.
But of course, they argue that that's a critical tenet of Watchtower theology, and it long has been. I remember in our previous episode talking to some other ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, we went into the many failed prophecies. I mean, you go back to Charles Taze Russell, Judge Rutherford. I mean, it's been a central tenet of the Jehovah's Witness organization predicting the end of the world time and time and time again. I don't know how many dates have come and gone that the end of the world was predicted. It was an absolutely sure thing. Here comes Armageddon, and it didn't happen. And yet, not only did it not discourage the followers of Russell and Rutherford and other since then, they've actually somehow strengthened their faith. They should go, wait a minute, these guys claim to be prophets of God, and yet look how many failed prophecies the Watchtower has predicted, and yet we don't see that happening. And as you described, you're implanting a phobia in children that stays with them long into their adult years.
Well, and I loved your analogy too of the plugging in. Who was the
Yeah, Rick Ross like said that.
Rick Ross, so they're plugged in and they're only getting the download. Mm-hmm. So if a witness heard what you just said, they would say, no, we never had any prophecies. There is no, all the literature has magically disappeared.
Oh, right.
So all the access that witnesses have to that literature has been vetted, or they don't have access to it. They could if they dug and researched.
Oh, yeah, it's out there.
They've been trained that that's old light. So we,
yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, I would have defended what you just said and said, but no, that was just old understandings. Now we have the true understanding. So
there's always a way to get around it.
Clint, yeah. I just feel for these guys because I was in there and I would have had an answer for everything. And it's just so hard to get into that bubble.
Well, and that's the eye of the Stephen Hassan's bite model is information control. If you can control the flow of information to your followers, which you just described, you can better control them. So if they don't, A, they either don't know about all these failed dates, or B, the convenient explanation is, well, that was old light prophecies. Now we have new light prophecies. We can dismiss all those. They're not even mistakes. They're just old light. We have better revelation now, blah, blah, blah. So there's always an answer, isn't there? There's always
absolutely
a comeback.
And there's got to be an incredible amount of courage for an individual internally to be able to stand up and think for themselves. So yes, it's all controlled and it's all funneled into it. But, you know, even when you do have a doubt, it requires a gigantic amount of courage. And I'm worried because, you know, there is so much control. I'm worried that individuals, you know, have been hammered down and quashed for so long that their courage, I just hope that, you know, they do find courage to think
it's
critically
very difficult.
And to get out.
And as you say, when you put the whole milieu controls, what Lifton describes it, the whole context of the entire organization makes it so difficult, first of all, as you say, even to entertain one critical thought, because it might be it's of the devil, or it's, you know, coming from the outside world, or you don't even know about it because you have your information flow is restricted to what information you've got. And then the fear of shunning, the fear, you know, if I leave, that's going to happen to me, as you described with that, when you were in the Kingdom Hall as a young girl, seeing that person and, whoa, I don't want that to happen to me. So I'm just going to stay in line. So it's the psychology of the pawn, really. You're just a pawn. You don't see that, of course, because we never said, oh, I'm in a cult. you wouldn't have, if I came to you when you were in the organization and said, Renee, you're in a cult, man. Of course I'm not. I'm in the true religion here.
Exactly. And you're describing it as a bubble is fantastic. And it really is. And it's very frustrating, Clint, for somebody like me, because I have brothers and nephews and nieces and my beautiful mom who I absolutely adore. And there's no way that I can get access to them. You know,
it's all closed off.
It's so closed. And that's what's really frustrating and upsetting for a lot of survivors, is because they really want to help people, but it truly is an incredible bubble. It's very, very strong.
Well, it's a self-sealing system. That's what Yanya Lalit, she's another sociologist and cult expert, and she describes cults as a self-sealing system. So when somebody leaves it, it reseals. You know, it's like that bubble, isn't it? It's like something out of a science fiction movie. You can struggle your way through the bubble and get out, only to turn around and find that the exit's been blocked now. It's been sealed. Mm-hmm. You can't get back in. And they're in there putting their fingers in their ears. You're now one of the enemy. You're an apostate in Scientology. Yeah. You're an SP, a suppressive person, whatever label you want to put on it. And you are now the enemy. You're a danger to them. You're a virus that can't be reintroduced back into the group. So the best thing to do is to cut someone like you off, the safest and best alternative. Even if you're family, you have to be shunned. And that's really a sad thing, because I've got family members who are still super hardcore fundamentalist Christians. They don't talk to me anymore for similar reasons, you know.
Yeah,
I'm a contagious virus. Yeah, I didn't know I was so dangerous. It must be the tattoos and the beard. I don't know, but I look scary. But you know, I'm a nice guy. But now let's get into this this rally that's coming up. This big massive conference. You mentioned it before. It's something that the Jehovah's Witness organization is putting on. How many people are expected to attend again? And what's it about? Why are they putting this conference on?
So the Jehovah's Witnesses have an international convention in various places. Last time Melbourne had it, I believe, was 2014. So it's 2019. They're having another international convention. Like I said, they're expecting between 60 and 70,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. And their theme is Love Never Fails. They are going to show ways in which families show love to each other. And I imagine one of the talks will probably be that disfellowshipping is a loving arrangement.
Oh, yeah.
And cutting family off is the only way to save us.
No, not a hint of irony. Not a hint of irony.
So at the same time, we're going to protest outside Marvel Stadium. So far, I have about 100 people who have registered with us. There's still 12 days to go. We haven't collected all names. I know there are more than that. I think it'll reach as much as 200 people possibly on Saturday or Sunday. And our theme is going to be Love Never Shuns as opposed to Love Never Fails. And we're hoping that we've got a two-prong approach. It's hard to crack into that bubble. We're hoping that some of our signs and our peaceful approach, it's going to be very peaceful and respectful. We're hoping that something in the signs or the fact that we've all come and we care enough to come might speak something to somebody. The other approach, and this is the side that I'm probably more interested in, is just trying to get the public to learn that Jehovah's Witnesses are not just a harmless friendly organization, because I think at the moment the majority of the public still is under the impression they're probably not really familiar with the Royal Commission. They're not familiar with the hidden child sexual abuse cases entirely. So just educating the public and letting them know that they need to keep an eye out, because maybe this group isn't as harmless as previously thought. That's the two-prong approach that we're looking at.
Are you getting any media coverage outside of talking to people like me and getting the word out on podcasts and other places?
I'm working on that. We are working on that. It is tricky to get media attention. We're putting press releases out, and hopefully we will have some of the local papers and news reporters hopefully come and cover the item on the day.
Now, some people would say, Renee, come on, 200 people versus 60,000, they're not going to pay attention. They're just going to steamroll right over the top of you. It seems like it's a drop in the bucket. But I'm glad that you're doing something, as small as it is in comparison to the size, and it's a juggernaut, isn't it, compared to what you're talking about and describing. Yeah. You ever get discouraged and think, my God, there's only 200 of us?
Clint, let me tell you what is marvelous. There is word internally that they already know that we're coming, and they're making preparations to sing outside. So apparently the story is they are very well aware, and some of the congregations are preparing some items outside, and that's fine with us because our protest is silent. Our banners will speak. We have seen in other situations where they try and cover the signs, so we're going to have to movable signs, which we are preparing to do that. So look, 200's not many, but I tell you, it's enough to have sparked a little bit of concern, and that's fantastic. And we're all going to be wearing nice bright blue t-shirts with a message on there. And if not for the witnesses, I'm sure the public will come to question what is going on, and will definitely make an impact. I know for sure. London was very successful. I'm not sure if you know about London.
Yes.
London had a protest last year, and they had about 100 people there. And they had people coming up to them later and just saying, look, I can't be seen with you, but just really quickly, I just want to thank you so much for coming. So if I even just get one person that to me or to our group, that's all I need, one person.
You
can change the life of one person.
You've made the juggernaut a little bit worried there. They're concerned. Yeah. Your message is actually getting through. And I was going to say, in today's social media savvy driven age, the fact that everyone's got a mobile phone, you can record things, you can put it straight up onto Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, everywhere else. Think about this. If this was 30 years ago, even 20 years ago, the avenues of getting the word out worldwide very, very quickly were not there. You didn't have the internet. It hasn't been around that long. Actually, people don't realize. You and I grew up in an age when there wasn't even mobile phones. I can remember when mobile phones became a thing. Big, huge, blocky phone with a big rubber antenna on it. Yeah. You know, that wasn't that long ago. That was in the early 1990s. So this has been around not that long.
You know, there's a lot of lonely people out there who've been silenced as victims, because when you're disfellowshipped, you really, you know, it's a very lonely journey, extremely. Mm. It's designed to be that way.
Absolutely.
It's designed. But now we've found each other. So the fact that we're doing this is really encouraging to all the survivors out there that are too scared to come out. I remember when the one was in London, I was always watching and streaming, and because I felt so happy that somebody was speaking up for me. That felt like me saying something. Mm. So it's going to be healing for all the people that need to be heard. And also we've heard messages from people who are stuck inside and can't leave because they don't want to lose their families. They're sending us anonymous messages saying, I'm so grateful you're doing this. So we've got people on the inside as well who we know
trying to get out.
Are going to get supported and, you know, yeah.
So your message is getting
through. There's so many
through.
Different aspects to this, I think.
Yeah, it's
sure,
a huge thing.
Sure.
And I'm encouraged by the fact that it's a worldwide thing, as you described here in the UK. There was the thing, as you say, in London. Now we've got Melbourne. Obviously, it's a huge thing in America. It's a massive. I mean, it started in the States. Their headquarters are still in upstate New York, aren't they? So
in Warwick.
Yeah. So, and I know there's controversy around that because I think they sold their building and they had their main headquarters right in New York City, didn't they? There was some controversy about the money. I don't even know, but yeah, they're everywhere they go. Maybe you could shed some light on it, but I'm glad that you're getting through.
Yeah. They just had very large real estate in Brooklyn and they sold that and relocated to Warwick. And of course, part of the success of the organization is that they use volunteer labor. So it's all free labor. So when they sold the Brooklyn establishment, apparently it was close to $1 billion in value for all the sets of buildings they had there.
Mm.
Obviously that goes into their coffers. And then the next, area in Warwick, you know, was a lot cheaper. So, and they used free labor to build it. So clearly there are financial benefits from that move.
Right. That's what it is. And prime real estate in Brooklyn. And where's that money gone? Well, as it turns out, they're shelling out potentially millions for, maybe they're using some of that for some of these lawsuits that they're currently facing and will be facing as organizations like yours are getting the word out about it. Speaking of which, what were we going to say? Go ahead.
I was going to say, so they do rely on contributions. So I know, for example, my mum always regularly contributed. So, you know, all that funnels into the work that they're doing into the buildings. And of course, that's how they make their money.
They stay afloat. Yeah, they're not like a typical cult where they're producing stuff and selling it on the street corners. I mean, you see Jehovah's Witnesses, they are on the street corners, but they're handing out free material. I think I mentioned in the other podcast, I used to see Jehovah's Witnesses when I'd come up out of the train station in Liverpool every Friday. There was this group on both sides of the street handing out their free literature at 8 o'clock in the morning. I mean, they were dedicated, you know, and I talked to them a few times. And as you say, the tricky bit is, for most passers-by, you would think this is just a good Christian organization. That's how they market themselves. And they have all this literature with real catchy titles and interesting, kind of intriguing questions. Yeah, what does happen when a person dies? And I actually have a lot of thoughts around that. You take the literature and off you go. And that's how it can start.
Clint, I like how you mentioned the word marketing, because even as a kid, I do remember that we were trained to be marketers of Jehovah's organization. We had to dress beautifully.
Yep.
We had to have big beaming smiles. We had to pretend that everything was happy, so much so that if there was a disagreement or, let's say, a child sexual abuse case, we were taught that you don't want to tarnish Jehovah's name. So it was all a marketing campaign to make it look, as I said before, squeaky clean. And it worked for a long time until the internet came along.
Until the internet. Yeah, that was that's the thing. You can't hide. But as we know, this is another thing that Rick Ross said in our podcast, is that the thing is, the internet's kind of a two-edged sword, because on the one hand, yes, it has done a tremendous benefit to people getting the information out there. If you're a Jehovah's Witness, you can get online if you really want to and find out all this stuff. There's ex-Jehovah's Witnesses groups all over the place, Facebook, Reddit, other places. Twitter is a huge community. But it also has allowed them to put their side of the story out as well. So, and it's a recruiting tool, certainly. So there's that aspect of it as well. It hasn't been completely beneficial from our point of view.
Yeah, absolutely, Clint. But I'm very optimistic that one day there will be regulatory aspects to the material that is on the internet, especially if it's directed at children. And I'm hopeful that one day an authority in Australia would say, let's look at this material that is being presented to kids and see that it's extreme propaganda. So at the same time, sure, they're basking in that opportunity now, but at the same time, they are making lots of evidence available to us about the propaganda that they're dishing out, which one day I'm quite certain will be certainly reviewed.
Well, and we know,
and not in a favorable light either.
Yeah, there are kind of like a WikiLeaks sort of things out there, isn't there? Where there are a lot of internal documents that the Watchtower tried to hide and suppress around this area have now been leaked to the public. So if you want to do a little bit of research, there are elements of stuff out there, isn't there, that you can find out. They've had a systemic and long-term campaign or internally to go about hiding and suppressing and covering this kind of stuff up. So it's getting out there.
Exactly. All the letters to the congregations and to the body of elders have all been uploaded. And so it's all very transparent now. So you can't see those letters that, you know, requested them to send all the information of all the pedophiles in their zone. And that's how we know that, you know, this infamous database is available, because they created it themselves.
Absolutely.
By requesting the lists of pedophiles in all the congregations. So, yeah, so it does backfire in a sense, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's all there. It's transparent.
Well, and you see the parallels with organizations like the Catholic Church. I mean, when you were describing the serial sexual abuse and how that's been covered up systemically, it's exactly like the Catholic Church, isn't it? The same type of dynamics are at play. You've got a situation, it's a sealed system with a person that's in a very high authority sort of position. People look up to that man, and then that means he's in a position to be able to abuse kids, and he knows he's going to get away with it. Chances are very good, and the organization will protect him. So in the case of the Catholic Church, they've just moved pedophile priests to another parish, and he's free to do it again, and it's happened over and over and over because the organization itself is vested in protecting that priest. So you've got a similar kind of dynamic in the Watchtower, haven't you?
Yeah, not so much possibly protecting the perpetrator, but protecting this reputation. This reputation that they built their entire organization, that we have to look like the best and that we are truly God's, you know, people. And so at all costs, we will keep that reputation clean. But obviously, as we know, it's come out now.
Yeah, you're blowing the lid off of it. Now, in terms of resources, what's the best way for people to, first of all, get a hold of you? Because there's still time before this protest in Melbourne. If people are in Australia or want to come down, there's still time to do that, isn't there? How can they get a hold of you? What resources do you have for the Jehovah's Witness, let's say, who's thinking about, you know, entertaining doubts and things? What are some resources out there?
Okay, so directly related to the protest, I'll start there. If they're interested in attending the protest, we have a Facebook group called Former Jehovah's Witness Reunion. They can join that. There will be vetting questions to make sure that, you know, we are making sure that it's a supporter. There is my Twitter account, Renee Kordeski. There's my Facebook page, Renee Kordeski, JW Survivor. I'm also on Instagram as Renee Kordeski. Basically, if they look up any ex-Jehovah's Witness communities on Facebook, they will have access, because I'm posting all the information on there as well. Any Australian ex-Jehovah's Witness community, there's lots of places. I can give you links if you can do that, Clint, and I can provide all those places. But it's important to register because we do want to make sure that the protest runs smoothly. We want everybody to make sure that they feel supported because this is massive. For some people, this is the biggest thing they're going to do. It takes a lot of courage. So we will all be there together. We are making it so that the group is supportive. We will have people there to look after people if they're feeling overwhelmed. And each night, starting on Thursday night, the 21st of November, we are having meetups each night so that we can recap what happened during the day. We've got a lot of people, Clint, who don't want to come to the protest because they can't. Well, they can't show their face, otherwise they lose family connections, or they are too triggered because it's very traumatizing, this stuff.
Absolutely.
So we've made the meetups so they can still feel part of all that excitement, but they can just do it in the meetups in the evenings without having that confrontational aspect of the protest.
Right. So there's other ways people can get involved. Other than actually standing out on the street,
as it were,
on the days. Right.
Because if you asked me a year ago when the London protest was on, I would never have done it. I have journeyed a long way in 1 year. I have found my voice, and I truly recommend this to people, to make a Facebook page or a blog and just tell your story as it is.
Mm.
And what that does is it gives you incredible courage. It makes you feel heard. People will say to you, thank you, that's exactly how I feel. So you'll be reinforced. And in that year, I've managed to grow so far now that I'm in charge or with a team of helpers in organizing a protest. And
that is amazing.
So I understand if people don't want to stand at the front of the protest because, you know, you might not be in that space yet, but please join us in the evenings. But let us know because we have to cater for numbers. I'd hate for massive groups to turn up. We already have lots of people for the evenings, but I just need numbers so that I can book the right venues.
I'm glad you're providing a sort of an alternative for people who, as you say, don't feel that they're not quite there yet, or for whatever reason, they don't want to be shunned by their family or declared an apostate or whatever it is, but they can still be involved in it kind of a little bit from the outside and maintain a bit of a distance there if they don't want to stand on the street on the days of the actual convention. Or they can get in touch with you via social media and reach out. So there's a lot of avenues, isn't there? I'm glad you're doing this. And your own journey. I love how you describe, even a year ago, you know, how far you've come in just 1 year. That is amazing. That's the reconstruction piece, I think, when you get to the point where you're actually going against the former religion that you were so a part of all your life. It's amazing.
And that's why it's important for survivors to tell their stories. And some people might say, oh, there's already lots of out there. But no, every single voice is individual and every voice will speak to somebody different. And when you create a blog or create a page and speak, that's going to reaffirm somebody like me or somebody who's out there who needs to hear that I am validated. What I went through was abuse. What I went through was unfair. And I am a victim, but I can now move in a way so that I can become a survivor and then heal even further so that you can actually find ways to enjoy life and to move on and, you know, and to find ways to be at peace with yourself.
Mm. Yeah. And it gives you the language. I think that's one of the biggest things with my experience is when you meet other people like yourself, you go, okay, so I'm not alone in this thing. I'm not crazy. This has happened to tens of thousands of other people all over the world. I'm not alone in this. And actually hearing someone else's story gives me the language to be able to say, yeah, that's the same thing that happened to me. And it's very empowering, isn't it? Hugely empowering. And that's part of the reconstruction piece as well.
Yeah. And things like, and that explains why I feel shame. And that explains why when I go to work, I always feel unworthy or not, or I don't like compliments or I struggle with making friendships and relationships these are all things that we have in common that you don't realize it all stems from the one thing,
Absolutely.
From the original story. It explains lots of puzzle pieces. Lots of puzzle pieces come together. And when you can build that picture of why you are who you are, then you can begin to work on it. And it's truly a marvelous thing. It really is magical.
It is. Different ideology, but the same psychology. And what I appreciate about Robert Lifton's work is that not only does he go through and identify these markers of cults, but he also talks about the psychological effect on people, what does it actually do to us psychologically when we go through these cult psychological tactics, how they were able to control us and indoctrinate us and manipulate us and keep us, implant phobias and on and on and on. You can actually go, okay, that's me. That's describing what, and I'm, as you say, as an adult, I can see why it's affected, how it's affected my relationship with other people, in my marriage, in my own psyche. I mean, it's unbelievable how it has affected us.
To such a granular level, to a daily level.
Yeah.
You know, I've written stories as simple as having trouble sitting in a cafe and looking around and just feeling so alone because you feel disconnected, you feel different. You've come from, you've had an identity crisis and you just feel like you're not quite connecting with everybody else. And it's a daily thing. And
absolutely,
that's why it's important to connect and understand how you're ticking and why you're ticking that way. Yeah.
Well, and that's one of the things I was going to comment when you were talking about growing up in it, because I grew up in fundamentalism. The difference with you and I is that we're called second generation. In other words, we were born into it rather than a person, a first generation who entered into the religion later in life and then left it maybe later. They had a sort of established identity before they joined the religion, whereas you and I, the only identity we had was the cult identity from day one. That was our personality, our identity. We didn't know any different. We were just buying into the downloads because it was the truth. We just believed it. Our parents told us it was true. Our authority figures in our churches or kingdom halls were telling us it was true. And then when we left, we didn't have a pre-cult identity to recover. We've got to establish a completely brand new one. Who is Renee? Who is Clint? I don't even know. You know, so that's a huge journey, isn't it? Absolutely massive.
It's massive. And what I'm also trying to encourage people to realize too is it does feel like a new identity, but really it's almost like an improved one of your old one, because what you've done is you've disconnected from what you were brought up as, and you can actually use your knowledge and what you've been through to now morph into a new identity and to make it what you want it to make it. So it's really an opportunity to have design into how you want to create your identity. So it's actually can be a really positive shift, you know?
It's scary, but on the other hand, benefits are, am I? I can sort of make myself into whatever I want to be, or find out. It's something that Laura Anderson said. She's a psychotherapist in our recent podcast. She said she encourages people, just go out and try different things. See what you like. Go to your coffee shop, have a different coffee every day of the week. Even something that simple. I don't even know what I like.
Yeah.
Try stuff, do different things. Try drawing, try painting, try playing football, try anything, try something. And you'll discover, hey, I really like this. I love music. I love that. Whereas you couldn't do those things before. So I'm so glad that, you know, you're on that journey as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I'm so glad that we got to chat before this convention, because I'm really fascinated. I want to find out what happens. So please keep in touch as this thing comes up. It's coming up in just a couple of weeks, isn't it? So this is all kicking off
It's in 12 days, so... Yeah, I'm really grateful, Clint, because you jumped on it. I'm really grateful that you do so much for the community, because I only mentioned it for 30 seconds. I think you replied immediately, so I'm really grateful. And just to repeat the dates, it's in Melbourne outside Marvel Stadium, November 22 to 24, but our meetups begin the night before on the 21st. And, just hope that, you know, if you get a chance to come and stand and show solidarity, if you can, and help us, you know, send a message, a peaceful message, but a message nonetheless that, you know, that must be said.
It needs to be said. And I'm so glad that we're able to get this episode out there as a special edition, just to get the word out. If someone connects with you, if nothing else off the back of this episode, then we're doing well, aren't we? And getting the word out there, raising awareness is huge, isn't it? Absolutely massive. So thank you so much, Renee. It was early in the morning for me, but I'm so happy. I don't care. I'll get up early.
Good on you.
To talk to someone in Australia. It didn't really matter because I'm normally up at 6 in the morning anyway. So it was a normal thing for me to get up early, but I'm so glad that we connected. I wish you all the best for this upcoming conference, and please keep in touch. Let me know how you get on with this protest.
Absolutely, Clint.
Thank
really
you, Renee.
Talking to you. Thank
I'll
you.
Keep in touch with you.
Thank All you right. so much.